She's one of the most fearless investigative journalists out there. Whitney Webb joins us to expose the tangled web of corruption that connects intelligence agencies, global elites, and tech oligarchs. She's dug deep into the Epstein files, she's followed the money, and she's connected the dots most journalists are too afraid or too compromised to touch. If you've ever wondered who's really pulling the strings behind closed doors, then stay tuned, because this is a conversation the powers that be don't want you to hear. Joining us now is one of the best journalists and researchers of our generation, the author of One Nation Under Blackmail, Whitney Webb. Whitney, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks, Kim. That's very flattering. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you are. The truth is the truth. And Whitney, I speak the truth. And you are one of the best researchers and journalists of our generation, for sure.
Thanks.
Speaking of which, recently, Ian Carroll was on Joe Rogan. And he mentioned you, and this made a lot of, you know, a lot, there was a, he talked about you. He then went to social media and talked about you. And you clarified some things that you felt like were not represented correctly in that obviously very widely seen interview on Joe Rogan, which I don't know why you haven't been on Joe Rogan, quite honestly.
I have ideas.
Hey Joe, get Whitney on.
Yeah.
If there's somebody to be, what do you think? Do you want to share why you think you haven't been on?
Sure. Well, you know, I know that he's quite cozy, really, to a lot of the big tech bros that have lined up in recent months with the current administration. And some of them I've been critical for a long time, sort of the Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, more broadly, the PayPal Mafia Network, obviously very associated with, you know, the UFC network that's owned by Ari Emanuel, and some of those figures that I've been pretty critical of in the past. So I would assume, you know, it's sort of related to that, because a lot of the people that he's tended to have on, at least lately, tend to be pretty much across the board very supportive of PayPal Mafia involvement, intimate involvement in government, and I am not. So I would assume it's somewhere along those lines, but, you know, I'm not necessarily involved in those decisions. And I don't know if I'd necessarily blame Rogan personally either, who's been actually rather complimentary of my work and has mentioned it several times on his show. But ultimately, very large podcasts like that have people that are involved with guest booking, for example, and may, you know, make decisions that Rogan isn't necessary, or, you know, turn down guests that Rogan might want to have on. I mean, who knows how those things really operate.
Right. The reality of it's probably not him making a lot of those decisions. He's probably very busy. And it's not that he's not the final line. I'm sure he is. But you know, you can only control what your staff brings to you. I mean, you can't control what your staff brings to you, and you can only say yes or no to what they present in front of you. And so if there's gatekeepers, I mean, that's kind of like the White House chief of staff, right? The gatekeepers there.
Yeah.
You're only presented with what you're presented with, and you get those options. And that's why it's really important to choose the right people who are around you to ensure that they're not going to gatekeep in a way that's...
Sure.
But also, when you're making hundreds of millions of dollars and you're parts of large platforms, you're going to have gatekeepers.
Well, I think even more than that, too, you know, I think it's been pretty clear with this administration and in last year's election that podcasts were really seen as a more important outlet for reaching the public than mainstream media, which I think is also pretty significant. So a lot of the biggest podcasts have definitely been arguably more influenced than others by that regard. And you know, a lot of these bigger podcasts, Rogan included, having Trump on, having J.D. Vance on. And I've been, of course, very critical of J.D. Vance's longtime benefactor, I guess you could say, Peter Thiel, who's also been on the Rogan podcast. You know, I don't, I think he, you know, some people there would prefer I didn't really maybe discuss some of those ties, because they do come up in my Epstein-related work. And some people, I guess, in the case of, you know, Ian, perhaps has been pretty supportive of Musk and some of these figures in government, but also, you know, does cite a lot of research for my book. So perhaps that was, reasoning, but it's speculative. You know, again, I don't really know. And I'm happy for him that he had a chance to do, you know, a big interview on, you know, the biggest podcast in the world, I guess. But as you noted, I did have some criticisms, but as it related specifically to my book in my work, because I felt like some of the things that were conveyed weren't necessarily 100% accurate. And so because that's seen by so many people, and I'm not really doing that many interviews right now, and I'm not as active maybe as I used to be on social media and things like that, obviously people are going to develop conceptions and opinions about my work that are being given by someone other than me. And so I felt it was necessary to kind of, clarify a few things.
And the thing that you wanted to clarify was that you've never made the claim that Epstein was Mossad.
Well, that was one of the two, I guess, main things that I wanted to clarify. So yeah, essentially my book does argue for a significant tie of between Epstein and the state of Israel. But really the claims that are detailed in my book argue for a tie between Epstein and really Israeli military intelligence, more specifically as it relates to like a formal Israeli intelligence agency. And Mossad isn't necessarily part of Israeli military intelligence, but is obviously part of the broader Israeli national security apparatus.
And what, so the what is the name of the Israeli military intelligence arm?
Well, so there's a military directorate that controls all of the Israeli military intelligence agencies that's called Amman. And that was basically run by Ehud Barak, a close Epstein associate, in the mid-1980s at the time that Epstein was alleged to have been recruited into that network via, you know, Robert Maxwell. Some of the claims for this come from former Israeli military intelligence operatives like Ari Ben Menashe, but also some other sources that have remained anonymous but are deemed to be credible, and some other things, you know, that happened over the years. And obviously there was some sort of tie there, you know, as Epstein was awaiting, for example, his sweetheart deal sentencing, you know, in the 2007-ish period. He was in Israel, presumably considering not returning to the U.S. to face, you know, whatever sentence he was going to be doled out. It was during the sentencing period, I believe. But according to, you know, local reports and, you know, Palm Beach newspapers, he was touring Israeli military bases, which kind of unusual if you're just a reclusive billionaire, you know, accused of sex crimes. You're just,
Do you think it's true that Israel, I mean, bringing up the fact that he was thinking about not coming back, I mean, we've seen a lot of claims about Israel protecting pedophiles. I mean, do you think that there's some truth to that?
I mean, yeah, I do. But I, you know, there's a figure that I've sort of been writing about who's not necessarily a pedophile, but he's accused of rape, the film director, Brett Ratner, who has some interesting ties to sort of the network behind Epstein and also to the Diddy cases. And a lot of organized crime ties that don't really seem to have been previously reported as it relates to Ratner. And Ratner was basically granted an Israeli passport a week after being Netanyahu's special guest at the UN alongside Alan Dershowitz. And he had previously, Ratner, done a major joint venture with this Australian a billionaire named James Packer, who is one of the main figures in the Netanyahu corruption trial that's still ongoing for bribery and things like that. So there's a lot of strange things that sometimes happen in these power networks, and sometimes, and I'm aware of other cases as well that involve pedophiles specifically, where allegedly, you know, they're granted the right to immigrate, and it's, you know, all the circumstantial available evidence points to them evading charges in other countries and wow, what have you. But that, you know.
So as long as they're Jewish, though, I mean, just to be clear, they're not like bringing in a bunch of pedophiles, you know, they're not like, oh, any and all sex offenders. And
no, it's a, well, I mean, Israel is a, yeah, Israel's openly, you know, at this point an ethno state. So it's only for that specific demographic, yeah, that benefits from those types of immigration policies there. Sure.
Mm-hmm. And it's our greatest ally. I mean, what's so insane to me is that people, especially on the right, I mean, Israel's getting plenty of criticism on the right, which is really nice to see, but it's also getting a lot of protection from people on the right. And a lot of them are these, you know, Christians or Catholics, and they claim that they care about kids and their number one top priority is kids and the pedo circles that they want to crack down on. And yet they just seem to gloss over the fact that there's, you know, that the Epstein operation clearly looked like a blackmail operation, and that they had no problem using underage kids in order to get that blackmail done. And the fact that Israel does seem to allow any sort of Jewish sexual offender or pedophile to run off and escape without being extradited back to wherever they committed the crime. I mean, it's, how can people defend this? I just don't understand the defense. I understand Congress and them being bought off, right? I understand the big money interests. I don't understand the average commentator and why they're, I mean, unless they're also being paid too, which is very possible.
Well, I think these days a lot of influencers are being paid, and there are, you know, scandals that have sort of, mini scandals, I guess, that have sort of come out to that effect. But, you know, it, as it relates, you know, just the Epstein scandal alone, depending on what side of the political divide you fall on and how easily manipulated you are, like what influencers or podcasters or whatever that you follow, you know, there's efforts to link Epstein to certain names specifically. So in the right, a lot of people tend to look at Epstein as, you know, Epstein and Bill Clinton, Epstein and Kevin Spacey, Epstein, you know, and just specific right. names. And then, of course, on the left will be a more focus on Epstein and Donald Trump and you know, figures that are more, you know, hated by that particular political demographic right now. And there's consistently been an effort to sort of focus on the salacious material of Epstein, the celebrity aspect, his ties to famous people, or his ties to politicians of one particular divide, so that depending on who you're listening to, can create an echo chamber, and people, you know, on the right in particular, may not necessarily, you know, connect Epstein's activities to, you know,
a blackmail operation for the state of Israel. Right.
Sure.
Like, rather than just it being, oh, it was a bunch of rich people who are sick. I mean, that's, you make yeah. a good point. That's kind of what everybody's, well, not everybody, but there's a lot of people that are kind of just reducing it to that. And
sure.
it's like, no, this thing was way bigger than that. This is an assault on all of us, on every single American is what that was. And you know, Europe as well. They collected a lot of blackmail on Europeans also, not just the United
States.
Well,
I mean, it's a global thing. And it's been going on for a very long time, but I do want to go back to why I chose to clarify this in particular, on Twitter, because as we've just talked about, I do absolutely think there was an Israeli state connection in some capacity, even if not Epstein being directly affiliated with, you know, Mossad as an agency. But I do, basically what the thesis of my book is something much broader than that. I basically argue that Epstein was part of this transnational network that's also really transgenerational, that was created through basically this fusion of organized crime interests and intelligence agencies going back to the 1940s. And this, of course, you know, would predate the existence of the State of Israel, which wasn't created until 1948. And these networks had already essentially come together by that point in time. And, you know, I essentially argue that there's a significant amount of CIA ties, US intelligence ties as well in this network, and that, you know, they're transnational in scope. And a lot of the organized crime network that's affiliated with this spans, you know, has a lot of interests in both the U.S. and Israel, but also, you know, has expanded through partnerships, for example, between people like Robert Maxwell and Semyon Mogilevich to Eastern Europe, Russia, and beyond. And I think a lot of the stuff, for example, that sort of percolated up what was true about the stuff people were trying to go after Trump for in Russiagate was really more related to this specific organized crime network, but you can't go deep enough to prosecute anything without coming up with ties to powerful people in Israel and also the U.S. And it's ultimately, you know, affects, at least as it relates to the U.S., both parties very significantly. Yeah. And I talked a lot about in my book about this particular network of oligarchs based in the U.S., that have been referred to by the Wall Street Journal as either the study group and the mega group, and how they seem to have a lot of influence over what Epstein was doing, and also, you know, really the governments of both countries, and pretty much most of the known members or earliest members of that group, including, you know, Leslie Wexner and Charles and Edgar Bronfman, have historic, if not continuing, ties to organized crime. So I basically make a much bigger case than saying Epstein was Mossad, for example. I think just saying Epstein was Israel is kind of reductive, because in trying to, if you really are interested in sort of informing people and it, with the intent of undoing this power structure's control over society, you have to understand that it's much bigger than any one nation state. And I think also, just like people trying to say Epstein was CIA, or for example, without mentioning Israel, it can be kind of myopic. You're absolving one of the other intelligence factions that was absolutely involved and sort of taking people away from the fact that power, the power of these networks is transnational. It's not exclusive to a single nation state. And I think, you know, those are ultimately important points. And what the evidence shows about Epstein is that he's tied to this particular network that, that knits together organized crime like oligarchs with intelligence agencies, and the influence that those networks have had, you know, not just on Epstein's own network, but how Epstein, you know, is basically middle management or a force for that broader network, and how he's making ties, for example, with every single major big tech CEO of importance. Obviously, Bill Gates got a lot of the focus, but, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Sergey Brin, Larry Page, all of these people are had some connection with Epstein.
But I mean, you do have to really start somewhere with it. I understand what you're saying, that this is a collaboration from, there's a lot of different powerful people with a lot of different powerful interests, and it spans the entire globe. And so it's not just, you can't just reduce it to Israel's influence on all of this. I mean, Israel can only have so much influence. So as long as, I mean, you can only blackmail people so much. A lot of it has to be them wanting to be a part of whatever it is you're doing, because they've got their own agenda, their own interests in whatever it is that they're, you know, if you're an oligarch and you're going to make a bunch of money, you don't need to be blackmailed, right? I mean, you could just be in, I mean, of course, the blackmail helps to keep you, to make sure that you're on the hook, but it's certainly, if you have your own interests, then it's even better because you're motivated. And so I see what you're saying, that this is like larger than just one intel agency or one nation. But I think the thing that makes it most offensive about Israel, because I do think we have to crack down on all of the influence, the oligarchy, the power structures that are everywhere. And I understand that they're harder to pinpoint and suss out when they're not as, you know, a country is easy to say, all right, a country has been in controlling, and a country has been blackmailing.
But who controls the country? Right.
Yeah. But I think what makes it the most offensive, what makes Israel more offensive, just blatantly, is the fact that what they're getting at. I mean, it's one thing for like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Peter Thiel, like here in the United, these are Americans. I think they're all Americans, right? Have they all gotten American citizenship? I think.
Well, sure. At this point they have American citizenship. Yeah, not all of them are, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they're Americans who, you know, they're siphoning perhaps the world or the American people for resources to an American company. I think we, and for their own, you know, their own control and their own money. And I think we can all say, yeah, we want to crack down on that because we don't want to be controlled or surveilled or have this kind of thing over us. But I think it's less offensive than a foreign country controlling us. And not only that, not only are they siphoning resources from us, but they're waging war. I mean, we're going to war on behalf of them. We're killing kids on behalf of them. And that is, I think, extra perilous, that causes us to focus more on Israel. And it's like, if we could just, I kind of wonder if we just rooted that out, and if we expose the fact that they've been able to blackmail our nation and our politicians and everybody, then we could at least start there and say, all right, let's start with the foreign country that's causing us to kill kids. And then from there, once we unravel that, then we could say, oh yeah, now all these players are also connected to all of these other things that we have to unravel.
Sure. But unfortunately, it's a little more complicated than that. I'll give you an example. So like Leslie Wexner's philanthropy at a time when his tax attorney was shot in the face and it was deemed linked to organized crime, and Leslie Wexner was tied to organized crime by Columbus. Ohio reports he, you know, is creating the Wexner Foundation, and one of the main focuses of that was not just training up Jewish American leaders in the United States, but also, you know, people that would later go and serve in the government of Israel, and greatly influencing them through, you know, the Wexner Foundation's Israel Fellowship and things like that, and later teaming up For example, you know, that kind of same line of the Wexner Foundation with the World Economic Forum's Young Global Leaders Program and things like that. So a lot of times these oligarchs can have a very outsized influence. And in the case of Israel, you have a lot of ostensibly American billionaires buying off Israeli politicians. And so there tends to be a lot of, you know, transnational stuff going on, because what happens when you have someone like Sheldon Adelson, who was the biggest Republican donor and biggest donor to Trump during Trump's first administration? He's ostensibly the, you know, the biggest donor in American politics at that point of time. But he's also on video saying that all he cares about is being a good citizen of Israel and that his children serve later in the IDF. You know, it ultimately, you can pinpoint perhaps, you know, some of this coming from the intelligence, you know, apparatus of Israel. But when you also have political power and politicians being essentially dominated by money flows by billionaires financing both countries, because Adelson also, you know, couldn't directly donate to Netanyahu, but bought entire newspapers to promote him in Israel domestically, you know, basically de facto donating to him. You know, there's a lot of influence there. And, you know, an American billionaire, Ronald Lauder, is directly responsible for Netanyahu becoming prime minister at all in the late 90s. So there's a lot of, I think, importance in looking at this particular transnational group and their influence, because a lot of them are very supportive of the ethno-supremacist paradigm that is typified by the current administration of Israel that Netanyahu leads, and obviously has been kind of a force in Israel for some time. But I think it's, you know, they're very active in promoting that ideology, and they're big funders to organizations like the ADL, for example, that train the FBI in what constitutes a hate crime or hate speech. And now that you're having, for example, the current administration move to criminalize certain types of hate speech targeting a specific group, and the ADL also has ties to, you know, the state of Israel as well as this transnational organization, you know, it becomes very problematic for both countries. So I don't know. I think it is a lot more complicated than just trying to blame one nation state, because, you know, you can try and go after Israel for that, but you're not going to be able to unless you realize that a lot of the power structure that enables that activity in Israel, you know, has a lot of antecedents with, you know, entities or people based in the United States.
That's where it gets really tricky, because there's so many, and that's like the problem with AIPAC, right? Is that their excuse is, well, we're Americans, so we're allowed to donate to the political, and just like Sheldon Adelson saying that he's like a devout Israeli, but he's an American. And so he was allowed to donate to our political system.
Yeah.
And that's so that, you know, that makes it quite complicated.
Well, I mean, if you look at, you know, history too, of like, you know, some of the most scandalous CIA operations of the last several decades, a lot of them were done jointly with Israeli intelligence. And so if you are interested, for example, in tackling the quote unquote national security deep state of the United States, it is completely tied up with the intelligence agencies of Israel at this point, to the point that, you know, I've been arguing in some of the work I've done for probably over almost a decade now, that really the U.S. has a binational security state. And then again, the military and intelligence apparatus's dependence on a lot of, you know, Israeli intelligence cutouts, arguably, and cybersecurity, a critical infrastructure and other things, it means that you can't really talk about separating the ties of the U.S. from its ostensible greatest ally without looking at those points. And so there's been a major effort to try and kind of prevent that separation from really even being possible. But a lot of it is made possible by these moneyed interests that greatly influence both countries. But again, it's broader than the U.S. and Israel, but you can see it very significantly by looking at the oligarch networks of those two countries in particular.
Yeah. I mean, it's a matter of national security, but at this point, because they've infiltrated our national security so deeply, like you've mentioned, that it's like, how do you unravel the two? But that's why they keep saying they're our greatest ally. And the rest of us are like, why exactly? I mean, what exactly have they ever done?
But our national security apparatus, I would argue, was compromised before Israel was even created by these organized crime interests, which was really a specific faction of organized crime that grew out of what was referred to once as the National Crime Syndicate, which was really a meeting of the Jewish mob and the Italian mafia, you know, Mayor Lansky and Charles Luciano. In some of, in before that, organized crime in the U.S. had sort of been separated in ethnic silos, right? So there's the Irish mob, there's the Jewish mob, there's, you know, it's by nationality or ethnicity, and they sort of broke that model down and became infinitely more successful than everyone else. But you could argue also that after Luciano was, you know, deported to Europe and all of this, that really the Lansky Syndicate ended up taking all
being
the
more
chips.
In control. So do you think that's what happened to JFK? I mean, do you think that the reason why he was killed was Israel or Jewish lobby or mafia, the Jewish mob and the Italian mob?
So I'm not an expert on the Kennedy assassination, because it's one of those things that has so, you have to spend years, I think, becoming an expert in the topic to really pontificate about it.
Yeah.
But I have obviously brushed up against various entities that have been blamed by other researchers who have taken that time for having at least some significant role in the Kennedy assassination. And ultimately, I think it's the same network that I argue was behind Epstein, which is a meeting of U.S. intelligence interests is and, you know, Israeli or Zionist intelligence interests and organized crime. But if you see that, you know, in World War II, they in the U.S. intelligence apparatus formerly teamed up with the specific organized crime network. And then that organized crime network armed the Haganah, the precursor to the IDF. And then a lot of these organized crime linked billionaire families that are still prominent, like the Bronfmans, furnished Israel's early national security state with, you know, what would now in today's money be billions of dollars in weapons. It kind of starts to make more sense of how we ended up here, so to speak. So if our interest is really to interrogate, you know, power here and where a lot of, you know, what we're observing today, where did it come from? We have to understand the history and realize that this is basically something much bigger than any one nation state. And in order to sort of understand how we can extricate ourselves from it, we have to have a pretty good idea of what, this power structure ultimately is, right?
How do you not just get, like, I listen to you and I just think, I give up. I mean, there's no way we're never going to take it back. We're never going to unravel this. It's too powerful. Just live a nice life, go garden and give up. I mean, that's how do you?
Well, I think you can live a nice life and garden and also not give up, which is what I attempt to do. I mean, basically, at the end of the day, these entities and this power structure have been successful because people have not really been aware of what's been going on and how interconnected a lot of these oligarch networks ultimately are, and how connected they are to our national security state. Because a lot of people, you know, if we're just talking about back to my point earlier, talking about Mossad, talking about the CIA. Who does the CIA work for? Who does Mossad work for? In the case of the CIA, it's very clear that it was created by Wall Street bankers who entered into questionable alliances with organized crime, and bankers and organized crime are both ultimately interested in expanding their rackets and is making as much money as possible. And so eventually you have certain economic networks and, you know, these alliances dominated what is now corporate America, the multinational corporation. That's who the CIA has, throughout most of its history, conducted coups on behalf of. So we have to go a level up if we really want to know what's going on and look beyond CIA and Mossad and see, you know, who's really, at least at the scale up, a key part of the power structure that's really running the show. Because, you know, it's important for them that the public doesn't really look that high up, because then it just seems like we can't really do anything about it, but I think people ultimately can. And, you know, what I've argued a lot for a long time is that, you know, people need to try and extricate themselves, you know, from, you know, the biggest iteration of what this mob is today, which is really big tech, which is, again, a lot of these CEOs connected to figures like Epstein or other questionable associations. And also almost all of the big Silicon Valley companies today have origins or funding tied to the CIA or to DARPA or to entities like that. And that we should boycott them as much as possible and not use their services as much as possible and not be dependent on these entities, because if we're dependent, then, you know, they can do whatever they want to us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the best way to not give up is to work to be as independent of those systems as possible. Because if we're dependent on them, you know, you're basically a slave to these people at the end of the day, which is what I think most Americans do not want. But I think there's a lot of efforts being made to sort of keep people in the box of where they think, oh, well, if I vote for this party or this politician and this candidate, I don't have to do anything to ensure my independence from the system. I can remain dependent on the system and hope that politician XYZ will magically, you know, save the day and fix the country and, you know, end this ruling power of 80 plus years of, you know, intelligence and organized crime. Yeah, I think it's really something that has to be sort of done on an individual level, and people need to take individual responsibility if they don't want to be part of this system, particularly as we move into this increasingly digital future that these very small handful of companies are going to completely control. Which kind of brings me to my other criticism in the aforementioned tweet about, you know, claims that were made about my work. So Ian in that interview described some of my work on big tech CEOs, namely Peter Thiel. He used the word unhinged. He later said that he didn't mean to use that word and should have used a different word. But in the context of saying that, also said that my, you know, my historical facing work, like on Epstein's history, was valuable. But basically, you know, in more or less implied that my work on current figures is not. But actually, my work on Peter Thiel is intimately connected to my work on Epstein. And in my book, One Nation Under Blackmail, I basically conclude with the point that someone like Epstein is no longer really relevant for intelligence services or organized crime networks or oligarch networks in the age of technology. And why is that? So, back in the day, you have Epstein and a litany of other figures like him, which I detail figures in my book. He was obviously not an anomaly at all. But that type of sexual blackmail operation comes with a lot of risk. It takes a lot of money to finance, you know, the person who's running it, their mansion, their parties, paying off women, all of these money flows. It can be risky. And it certainly ended up being that in the Epstein case, right? Because he was kind mm-hmm. of, you know, he was discovered, arrested twice. And it obviously took a lot of money to cover things up, at least the first time and arguably the second time as well, where he ended up dead. So what's a better alternative? Well, if you have everyone onboarded onto digital systems that you control, like the CIA being at the origins of Google, DARPA being at the origins of Facebook, the CIA being at the origins of Oracle, and a lot of these other entities, Bill Gates and Microsoft having ties to the Maxwell family as early as the late 90s and things like that. And obviously Gates and Epstein, you know, what does that ultimately mean? Like, I think, you know, at this point in time, we've learned through either whistleblowers or other means that intelligence agencies access or can access pretty much any part of our digital footprint, no matter how secure we tend to think it is. And that's like with revelations about, you know, ostensibly secure messaging apps like Signal being compromised or having had some sort of military funding and its origins or what have you, you know, it's much easier to suck up all of Americans' communications without a warrant. And that necessarily is in the hands of a lot of these same agencies with dubious track records that have engaged in blackmail in the past, like the CIA, for example. And so, you know, with that kind of technology, you don't really need someone like Epstein anymore. Someone like Epstein becomes expendable because you can use technology for that. And I argue in the book that Peter Thiel's Palantir was basically a repurposing of this DARPA program called Total Information Awareness that was developed by the Iran-Contra criminal who was exonerated by William Barr when he covered Iran-Contra and other notable scandals of the era up in the first Bush administration. You know, Poindexter's considered the father of modern surveillance, and it was basically, he was running this Total Information Awareness program. Peter Thiel and Alex Karp came to him, being connected through Richard Perle, who has longstanding ties to the state of Israel and also the U.S. neoconservative movement, and also Netanyahu. basically, you know, bringing those together at looking for a way to privatize Total Information Awareness after it came under congressional scrutiny and was ultimately defunded by Congress because of private outrage that it would eliminate the US, the constitutional right to privacy for all Americans, which is absolutely true. But the outrage disappeared when it was entirely a private company and Palantir was incubated by the CIA. The CIA was its first customer for its several years. It was a client, and now it's a key part of, you know, IDF AI mass slaughter in Gaza, and has been a key part of the U.S.-Israel relationship since then. But more specifically, domestically in the U.S., it is the engine on which the warrantless mass surveillance runs. It collects everything about everyone and makes it disposable to intelligence agencies, and it's very easy to find blackmail on people with an entity like Palantir being so widely used.
That to me is really scary, the fact that I mean, with the internet and everybody's on the internet, and also people can plant stuff on your devices. They can
point. It's true.
So we're all blackmailable, unfortunately, at this point.
The digital era has certainly changed things, and I think that's why it's very interesting that you have sort of Epstein, after his first arrest, pivot so much towards Silicon Valley and these, you know, major Silicon Valley CEOs whose companies were built up with national security state involvement. You have someone like Epstein who was tied not just to sex blackmail, but arms trafficking and money laundering for intelligence, being involved with these people to a significant degree. I mean, some of these big tech CEOs like Sergey Brin and even Elon Musk were subpoenaed or attempted to be subpoenaed as part of the USVI JP Morgan case, for example, that was settled to keep the trial from happening, to keep all of that evidence out of court, arguably. But it's very problematic. And by the way, JP Morgan, you know, Jamie Dimon, the reason Jamie Dimon is CEO of JP Morgan is because of two of these mega group billionaires, the Crown family and Leslie Wexner, because they installed him as head of this Bank One, that later merged with JP Morgan. And after the merger happened, Dimon's in charge of JP Morgan. So it's really shouldn't be any surprise that Epstein did so much banking for his, you know, trafficking operations with JP Morgan in particular. But again, not a lot of interest in looking in at that. But, you know, a lot of these entities have so much influence over so many industries. And so, you know, again, I think just focusing on specific intelligence agencies, it's important to understand that there's a lot more going on than just that. And ultimately, those spy agencies are working for somebody and are controlled by somebody's, right?
Yeah, I give up. I'm just going to go start gardening. It's just that the web of it is, and you bring up a great point when it comes to tech. And I don't know how anybody could ever call you unhinged, quite honestly, or any of your takes unhinged. I mean, you're so well researched and you're putting everything together so well. And, you know, I understand that people don't want to look at somebody like Elon Musk and think, oh, this guy has, because he just seems so innocent in the way he talks and the way he is. And I think that's true.
Well, a lot of people, he's the richest man in the world. And I'm sure the richest man in the world can afford people that, you know, help brand him online and tell him what to wear and how to style his hair and what memes to post and all sorts of things to reach out to the common man. But yeah, I think there hasn't been a lot of interest in a lot of prominent media figures and really looking at really any of the PayPal mafia types, namely Musk and Peter Thiel, who in the context of this administration are highly significant figures.
Yeah, I don't think people really want to pay much attention to the PayPal mafia because they like everybody in the PayPal mafia, mostly. Like, there's a lot of personality there that people follow and like, and they think that they're going to come in and save the country. And they're using a lot of that language. Yeah. And I think in some ways they are, because you always want to throw like something good at the people in order to get them on your side. And then you're doing some other things that maybe the people wouldn't agree with, but you just don't talk about it and you hide it, right? Like all the surveillance stuff, the tech stuff, the fact that the military industrial complex has moved mostly into the tech sector. And so now,
Silicon Valley and national security are absolutely fused. You can't tell where one ends and one begins anymore. It is absolutely a public-private partnership, 100%. Right. But I think people got outraged, especially during the COVID era, at the public side of the public-private partnership, that now the focus of which side of that is meant to build trust with the public has shifted to the private sector.
Yeah,
we can trust the private sector because the public sector failed us during COVID and during all of these things. Look how corrupt the public sector is. Not denying that there's a lot of corruption in the public sector, but that doesn't mean that there isn't corruption in the private sector as well, or that a lot of these private sector entities, like I mentioned earlier, with a lot of these big tech firms, would not exist if it was not for the public sector and the national security apparatus that created them.
That's what makes me not trust Elon, is the fact that he has all those government contracts. And
he has a lot.
Yeah. So it's like, he's still, even if, like, let's just give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's just say the guy is genuinely a good guy, nice guy. He really does want the best for everybody, but he's still, he's an ideologue on one thing, and that is colonizing Mars, right? We know that that is the one thing he wants to really do that project. It's like a pet project of his. And it's when you get into those pet projects, like Bill Gates, who I think had the pet project of, I want to be known as saving the world, you know, rather than just the Microsoft guy. And so he goes into the health sector and he starts doing the vaccine stuff. And I think a lot of these stem from a personal drive, a personal desire. And then, of course, because these are so big and they become so unmanageable, there's a lot of other entities that get involved. But I think, you know, if you're Elon Musk and the one thing, your one pet project is Mars, you don't want to piss off the government, because the government won't let you send rockets up into space anymore. I mean, they could tell you, we're not going to let you do that. And if you want the ability and you want the contracts and you want all of this stuff, and because you're going to need the funding in order to build a colony on Mars, right? You've got to be pretty rich. So you have to have all of that. I think people underestimate how willing people are to compromise in order to achieve their own personal pet desire or their own, you know, what they believe. And we see that even like with the Zionists, for example, Christian Zionists, who many of them are not bought off by Israel at all. They don't need to be. They were inadvertently, without them realizing it, their churches were infused with a lot of money. Churches run on donation. A lot of donation was pumped in by Zionists that then told the preachers, go in and preach Zionism basically to all of your people and get them to believe. And then they became believers. And then it's like they just genuinely believe it. It's in their soul. Like, I kind of wonder if Mike Huckabee's that way. You know, he's just so pro-Israel that I'm like, is this really, are you bought off, or is it just a zealotness from your religion? And I think it might be more of the zealous. He's just a zealot. I think Elon is like a zealot for Mars. And when you have that kind of zealousness, you're willing to compromise in order to achieve your ultimate big goal.
Yeah, well, arguably one of the reasons that Musk is so interested in Mars, and he said this on Twitter, is because he wishes to impose he wants to create the Mars technocracy, which is significant because technocracy is a model of government that arguably is being rolled out on sort of a global scale here on Earth right now. And notably, Elon Musk's grandfather was the head of the technocratic movement when it existed, you know, several decades ago in Canada, and you know, has been pretty vocal that he, you know, supports the technocratic model. just in general, which is kind of problematic because ultimately technocracy is about a rule of society by a scientific elite that, you know, ultimately in terms of its philosophy, view the masses basically as programmable automatons that don't really have free will and are sort of not really that different from animals.
I could see Elon going in that direction. I could see him view, I mean, the way he pumps out babies and without thinking that, you know, being a father and being actually there matters, you know, the way that he views human beings seems to be along those lines.
A lot of these types of figures certainly view their own genetic stock in a different category as the masses, right? And I think that's
but he clearly just views people as it's like not human the way he views human beings, even the way he just makes his own children through IVF surrogacy, pumping them out with various different, I mean, even just that mentality is clearly the humanness of humans is not there.
I'm not super familiar with, you know, his relationship with his own kids, but I am more or less familiar with, you know, some of the other ambitions, you know, I've been more focused on some of his, for example, his ties to, I guess, the Maxwell family or Epstein world, which tend to go underreported. And of course he will publicly posture like he had literally no affiliation at all, with them. And I think that is definitely less than honest and have said this, in detail in the past, and also on some of his, you know, obviously his military contracts, which are pretty significant, but some of his other ambitions as well, for example, for Twitter, openly wanting to turn it into something like WeChat, which has been criticized in the past by people on the right, which now very openly support Musk. For being kind of, you know, for being an Orwellian system. It's basically a public-private partnership with the state for policing speech, among other things, and for mass surveillance. And it's very likely that Twitter is, you know, moving along those same lines. And the idea of sort of having it be a one-stop shop for all your finances, which is what WeChat kind of is in China, would give Elon Musk a lot of power. Because ultimately, you know, if we're in the age where data is the new oil, instead of having oil barons like we had, you know, back in the 19th century, now we're basically having data barons. And so who runs the infrastructure, who runs the apps, all of that. Musk is poised to be one of the biggest data barons of our age. And what type of power comes with that? Well, it comes with the power to essentially remake society however you want. And so his interest in technocracy, which is also shared by some of these other likely data barons of the future, like Mark Andreessen, for example, among others, you know, should, I think, be scrutinized. And if this is the type of society we want, where we're basically going to be ruled by algorithms that are not human, and only certain people maintain those algorithms. So perhaps, you know, it would be framed as, you know, a more egalitarian society and that all of society would be governed by the algorithms. But that isn't necessarily true, because you obviously are going to have an upper class that programs and maintains the algorithms and decides what their parameters are and what they do. And this is basically outlined in this book by the former Google CEO Eric Schmidt and Henry Kissinger, that this will inevitably happen when AI takes over government. And you could argue that a lot of the efforts being made by Doge, and I'm not going to say that I'm not defending the stuff they've been ostensibly exposing, because obviously there is a lot of corruption and pork, like just like there's pork in the spending bills. Obviously there was plenty of that in in the public sector. And I don't really think it should be that surprising, but the question is, you know, what is that what changes is that used to justify? And pretty much across the board, it's putting, you know, AI in greater control of government. So if you're, if it's your AI, for example, in the case of Elon Musk, Grok, right? Or if it's OpenAI in the case of Sam Altman, and, you know, your algorithm has replaced the jobs of 20,000 people, then you have arguably the influence that those 20,000 workers had on the organization that's employing you, or now your algorithm. So, you know, there's a lot of things to be discussed here, and even if people like Elon, it's very complicated to argue that you're furthering the cause of liberty and freedom and all of that when you're centralizing power to such a significant degree and cheerleading that on. And also a lot of policies that Elon Musk has long championed, the right doesn't like carbon pricing, carbon taxes, things like that. Actually, a lot of public policies that Musk has long supported are policies that have long been supported by entities like the World Economic Forum.
Yeah.
But now, you know, it has a very different sales pitch behind it. A lot of these policies are being framed as libertarian. Right. But, you know, there's a lot more. I think people should look less at the sales pitch and more on what these policies functionally mean. So as an example, you have the political philosopher who's like the supposed house philosopher of the PayPal mafia, Curtis Yarvin. And Curtis Yarvin has a quote that could have come from Klaus Schwab or Yuval Noah Harari about how the masses need to be dealt with and that it's a humane alternative to genocide to have people in pods plugged into a virtual world to entertain them and basically be like waxed like bees in a beehive. And, you know, basically being plugged into the metaverse or something. Yeah. I mean, how is that really functionally different? I guess in Yarvin's argument, he would say, well, it would be, you know, a corporation or a GovCorp, a governing corporation or a public-private partnership, I guess, that would, you know, put you in a pod and control the metaverse, but isn't really that functionally different. And, you know, if people can be convinced to buy, you know, Teslas after that was the liberal car on the right, just to own the libs, I mean, I think it wouldn't be that hard to make a sizable demographic exist that would get Neuralink in a few years just to own the libs and things like that. You know, it's kind of a slippery slope. And I think people sometimes are naive about how easily we can be manipulated, oftentimes through the engineering and manufacture of celebrities that are pushed in front of us. And the way that algorithms can do that now is extreme. Because they've harvested so much data about us, they have profiled us so extensively, they know exactly what to show you to get you to be persuaded about certain things, depending on what demographic you're in.
We are definitely easy to manipulate and guide in the direction that they want us to be guided in. I mean, it's all very dystopian, Whitney, and I mean, you are a wealth of information. I really appreciate you being on and sharing with us your perspective on that and your research on that, because I think more and more people need to be aware rather than just following the cult of personality, which is kind of what we're seeing. And I've been really disappointed with people on the right for, you know, seemingly champion and for the last several years, seemingly champion bringing things back to the people, only to just human nature, just fall back into the trap, you know, fall back into the trap of just following along because we've been easily manipulated and we can follow the narrative. So
yeah,
Whitney, thank you again for being here. I really appreciate your time. We've got your book, One Nation Under Blackmail. The link is down below. You're also a contributing editor to Unlimited Hangout, and we have that link down below. You're not really much on X, but we do have the link so people can follow you there, even though you don't post much, but really appreciate your insight, your intelligence, your research, everything that you do, Whitney. Thank you so much. Thank you for watching this clip from the full Kim Iverson Show, which you can watch Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific at kimiversonshow.com. See you there.